Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
US President Donald Trump has met Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sarraj, in Saudi Arabia shortly after lifting all US sanctions on Syria. Now, President Trump has just left Riyadh this morning and is now travelling to Qatar. Well, the meeting that happened earlier is part of Mr. Trump's lavish four-day tour of Gulf states, where the US president yesterday declared, "We've launched the golden age of America. The golden age of the Middle East can proceed right alongside us." But back home, the picture is less glittering, because since his Liberation Day tariffs sparked tremors in the bond market, the president has announced a succession of 90-day pauses and carve-outs for key sectors and countries. Well, to discuss all of this, I'm joined in the studio by EY's chief US economist, Gregory Dacko, and from Riyadh by Middle East correspondent with The Economist, Greg Karlstrom. And I'll come to you in Riyadh, Greg, first. That historic meeting with Syria's new leader, that is the first between the United States and Syria, their leaders, in 25 years. So can you tell us what's been happening and what the outcome was?
That's right. You have to go back to, I think it was the Clinton administration, was the last president to meet with Hafez al-Assad, the late Syrian president. This meeting would have been certainly unimaginable 6 months ago, before the fall of the Assad regime in December, and even a few weeks ago, it seemed like it was in doubt. There are some people in the Trump administration who have advocated a very tough line on Syria, who have urged President Trump to maintain sanctions, to distance himself from the new Syrian president. But there had been a lot of lobbying by countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Turkey, urging him to take a different path. And it seems that in conversations with the Saudi Crown Prince and the Turkish president in recent days, Trump was finally convinced to meet with Ahmed Sarraj.
I just see in the last couple of minutes a flash from Reuters, Greg, saying Saudi Arabia's foreign minister has said in the last couple of minutes that the United States and Saudi agreed to end the war in Gaza and release all hostages. Now, I'm not sure if you had heard that line from the foreign minister in Saudi Arabia, but that would seem like an aspiration.
I think it is. I mean, that has been the goal for the Saudis and for other Arab states for many months now. And it's something that Trump at times since becoming president has said, including in a social media post earlier this week. He called it a brutal conflict, and he said it was time for the war to end. But getting there will require pressure on the Israeli government. It's going to require Trump to apply pressure to Benjamin Netanyahu to accept not just a short-term truce and a hostage deal, which is what the Israelis are hoping for right now, but a permanent ceasefire. And it's still not clear whether or not Trump is going to strong-arm the Israeli prime minister in that way.
Well, the harrowing images we have seen from Gaza in the last number of days, malnourished children, and we have the reports now that 53 have been killed in the most recent strikes in the area. We also know that Israel is threatening to reoccupy the territory in its entirety. To what extent do you feel that those events are overshadowing Donald Trump's visit to the Middle East?
Countries in the region were very worried that it would. The Saudis, the Qataris were hoping that before Trump arrived, there would be an announcement of at least a temporary ceasefire in Gaza, so that you wouldn't have exactly those sorts of split screen images that you were describing. Obviously, that didn't happen. The Saudis made a point of not mentioning Gaza much in public while Trump was here. They asked the administration not to dwell on it either. I thought it was notable yesterday when Trump gave that nearly hour-long speech in Riyadh. He didn't mention Israel at all, and he spent very, very little time talking about Gaza. He said, you know, people there deserve a better life. We want a ceasefire. But he didn't spend much time really talking about it. And I think that was at the urging of his Saudi hosts.
There has been some talk of a growing rift between the Americans and Israel. And I don't know if you have seen much evidence of that. I mean, what we know is that Donald Trump has cut this deal with the Houthis. They're still attacking Israel. We saw the release of the American-Israeli hostage, and that deal apparently done directly between Hamas and the Americans. Is there any sign of that rift over the last couple of days?
There is, and I would add to that list the announcement of nuclear talks with Iran, which Trump announced in the White House in early April while he was sitting next to the Israeli Prime Minister in the Oval Office. And again, seemed to take the Israelis by surprise, and that was certainly not something Netanyahu wanted to hear. So we are seeing, I think, that Trump has his own sense of what American interests are in the Middle East, and that when he needs to, he's not afraid to go over Netanyahu's head and pursue those interests. But whether or not that's going to mean he wants to seriously try and end the war in Gaza, again, we just don't know yet.
Now, President Trump has billed that this trip to the Middle East is all about deals, about business deals. There have been many investment deals announced so far, and I would imagine you would expect that we will hear more when he touches down in Qatar.
There was a big package announced in Saudi Arabia. The White House says it's worth $600 billion altogether. The Qataris, I'm sure, will have something of their own to offer. And then the United Arab Emirates, the third stop on Trump's trip, has already promised $1.4 trillion over 10 years. But I think some of those figures are going to be aspirational. If you look at what's in the agreement signed with the Saudis, there's a $142 billion arms deal as part of that package. That is about twice the kingdom's annual defense budget. And it comes at a time when Saudi finances are very strained by low oil prices. So it's hard to see how the Saudis are actually going to deliver on that. They've signed an agreement that says we're interested in buying certain weapons, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to finalize those deals. And I think that applies to some of the investment pledges as well.
Greg, thank you very much for joining us. Greg Karlstrom there from The Economist. And as I mentioned, I'm joined in the studio now by EY's chief economist in the United States, Gregory Dacko. Gregory, thank you very much. And it's good to have you in
Thank
with
you.
us. So coming back to Donald Trump's economic policy, his tariff announcement and Liberation Day, in your analysis, in the events that have happened since, did the bond market shocks prompt the change of course, or is that how you categorize it, that there has been a definite shift in the strategy here?
I think the bond market certainly played a key role in readjusting the narrative from the administration. We saw Treasury Secretary Bessent come out and readjust the narrative around trade policy after wild fluctuations in the bond market. The equity market fluctuations weren't as big of a catalyst in terms of reorienting the trade policy from the administration. But you've heard over the last couple of weeks Treasury Secretary Bessent highlight this notion of a ceiling in terms of tariff rates and a floor.
Mm-hmm.
The floor is 10% on all trading partners. The ceiling was 145% tariffs on China. We're going to be in that range over the course of the next few months, with some deals being announced, but also sectoral deals and sectoral tariffs being imposed and carve-outs being negotiated with different trading partners.
Well, we all want to know, can the EU strike a deal now while the iron is hot, if you like, while this change of course is in play? Do you think it strengthens the hand of the European Union?
Well, I think that's an open question because there was a lot of optimism around the UK trade deal, but that is a very specific situation. The US currently runs a trade surplus vis-a-vis the UK. UK imports represent about 2% of total US imports, so it's a much less important negotiating partner with regards to trade vis-a-vis the European Union.
So we can't take that and use it as a template, you're saying?
I don't think that's the right template to use, nor is the China deal a good template to use as well, because we were coming down from 145% tariffs, which were essentially an embargo on trade between the two nations. With regards to the EU, it's much more complicated. The US runs a trade deficit on the merchandise front vis-a-vis the EU, and it's much more delicate to negotiate a deal across a number of sectors. The automotive sector, the steel and aluminum sector, for instance, are key sectors where the administration is going to want to protect U.S. industries and therefore likely to retain a fairly high average tariff rate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the EU will likely be not the next trading partner with which there will be a negotiated deal, but one in the line.
We say, oh, there's a pause in the trade war. We needn't be as worried as we were when this was announced. We shouldn't be complacent, right?
I don't think we should be complacent at all. I think the open question is very much, are we moving to a new status quo and what that new status quo is with regards to trade policy? Because we've had a number of announcements over the course of the past 2 months with tariffs being imposed first on China, China on the back of drug trafficking, then on Canada and Mexico, two of the largest trading partners for the U.S., then on steel and aluminum, automotive imports, and then the surge in tariff rates that were announced on Liberation Day, April 2nd, with tariffs across all major trading partners, and on China, this escalation to a very high level of tariff. What we've seen over the course of the last few days is essentially this desire to move to something that is more palatable, which equity markets have taken in stride and surged on. But from a real economy perspective, you still have 10% tariffs on most imports into the U.S. and 30% tariffs on China, which is extremely disruptive to business activity.
So what advice in that context would you give to a small open economy just like ours here in Ireland? We see ourselves as being a bridge between the United States and the EU. How do we handle all of this?
Well, I think you handle it better within the framework of the European Union. You're stronger together as a group, and that is where you have more trading negotiation power. When it comes to the EU, you really have to think about the key industries that the EU exports to the US and focus on how the U.S. administration can benefit from trade activities between the two nations. Mm-hmm. Where are the investment opportunities? Just like we were talking about the Middle East promising to invest in the U.S., that is really an avenue that works well, resonates well with the U.S. administration. What are the investment opportunities into the U.S. that could be made over the course of the next few years?
Mm-hmm. And we have no choice when it comes to trade. Our competency on that matter rests with the EU. The problem is Donald Trump has said very openly and repeatedly that he has very big issues with the EU, but not with Ireland. He likes us, but we have to go in there and negotiate as part of the EU. Do you see that as a problem for Ireland, and how can we mitigate against it?
Not necessarily. I think you have strength in numbers, right? And when you have a trade deal that's negotiated with the EU, it's going to benefit all economies within the EU. So I don't necessarily think that there's a benefit in going at it alone. Mm-hmm. What can be done on a country-by-country basis is looking at which industries are actually potentially going to benefit the U.S. and at least present that as a potential benefit to the U.S. economy, and where there could be greater investment into the U.S. economy from a CapEx perspective, from a reshoring or nearshoring perspective.
So on pharma then, we had this executive order signed by Donald Trump, and you know this is of particular interest to us here in Ireland because the pharma industry is so large. What does it mean? I mean, he has said he wants drug prices to come down for American consumers, but is it aspirational?
Well, I think we all want drug prices to come down in the U.S. This is not a partisan issue. This is a bipartisan issue. You saw the Biden administration before that argue for also lower drug prices, and this has been a recurring issue over the last 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. The issue is that it's first and foremost a domestic issue. So any type of executive order will first focus on the domestic dimension of drug prices, and it's not just a private sector issue. It's also a public sector issue because some of the drug prices are administrated via some of the public programs like Medicare, Medicaid. So it's not just about forcing companies to lower their drug prices. It's also about rethinking the entire healthcare system, insurance pricing included, to ensure that you have the lowest potential drug prices for all U.S. Consumers.
I mean, what has he actually done? I mean, he's just urged companies, hasn't he, to reduce their prices. That's not going to work.
That's not going to work. It's also been attempted in the past and been blocked by courts. So it's very difficult for any administration to mandate prices, to fix prices. It's going to always be contested from a legal perspective. It has been in the past, will likely be done so again. And therefore, I don't see much strength, potency in this executive order in terms of actually doing anything significant when it comes to drug prices.
Okay, well, much remains to play out on all of this. Gregory, thank you very much for coming in to us. That's Gregory Dacko, who is EY's chief economist in the United States. Back after this break.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.